Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Rock On Tours was recorded before the passing of David Crosby.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. So, the first UK singer-songwriter female to have international success.
Yes. She's actually, she kicked down a lot of doors, didn't she?
Yep.
I don't mean in a sort of the rock and roll sense. She's also a trailblazer, I think.
50 years in music. 50 years in music. And I don't think I kind of appreciated that, you know, that first album was 1972 with Gus Dudgeon.
That's right, and it was Gus Dudgeon. I bought the Joan Armour Trading album. Oh, spoiler alert! I bought that album. You know, when I was 14, 15, and I wasn't really buying those sort of records. Because you remember the first time you heard Love and Affection, right?
Yeah, of course. Actually, I do.
I mean, it was so powerful on the radio.
I was in a pub in Potter's Bar, and I just been rehearsing with what eventually became Spandau Ballet, right? So this is late 1976, I think. Anyway, I mean, I remember going to the pub after school. How naughty is that? 16 years old. And that track came on.
You'd been
on,
going for 2 years, though, hadn't you? That, we all had.
That track, yeah, came on the jukebox, as it were. And, I think everyone just sort of stood still and listened because it was so affecting. Guy, there are horses behind you.
There are horses behind me. I'm still on this fabulous tour with Georgia Bing, my missus, going around primary schools in the north of England with her talking about her new book and encouraging kids to be creative and write, and also to teach them about, you know, how plant-based eating is the future for all of us if you want to save the planet. We're staying with some friends of her mum's who are on a stud. So there are 60 horses in the grounds around me, all being trained.
You're like Jack Hargreaves, aren't you? You know,
Rock On Tours, which is basically Jack Hargreaves and Bill Frindle.
I know. Actually, I think that's the second or third time Jack's been mentioned on this show. You see this?
How?
Yeah. How? I tell you how. We're going to get Joan Armour Trading on.
Let's get her on.
Welcome to the Rock On Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a party. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience? Experience,
oh, yeah,
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock On Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Joan.
Hello.
Lovely to see you.
And you?
So much for coming on.
Pleasure.
you're not at Bumpkins, are you? Or your studio?
I'm at home.
Oh. But it's such a pleasure to have you on. You know, I mean, you've been in our lives for so long. This is your 50th anniversary, isn't it?
Yeah, you guys aren't doing too bad either, though.
But we were just saying, Joan, how we can both remember exactly the first time and where we were when we heard Love and Affection.
Oh, right.
It was such an incredibly powerful record. I remember I bought that album because of it. At the age of 14, 15, when I just, you know, I wasn't buying that sort of thing. It was fantastic.
That's right.
It's lovely to hear. I now and again get people from heavy metal bands saying, this is the record I bought. And I just heard, I can't remember the name of the band, but it's a very heavy metal, you know, that raw thing. They did a cover of one of my songs, Bad Habits. in that, rah, 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 you know, that,
oh, really?
That voice when they sound like monsters.
Oh, well, with a lover, I could really dance.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh,
yeah. Right.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny with that track, because I bought that as well. And I was buying punk at the time. And I wouldn't have bought Carole King's Tapestry then. That was too much for
you
me.
You should have.
Yeah, I know I should have done. And I did later.
A lot of time.
But there was, you know, the singer-songwriter wasn't really in my world, you know. But that record, for some reason, seemed to cross over. It had, and I think it's something to do with your voice. Something to do with the rawness of emotion that you managed to project in your vocal.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. But when I listen to anybody that I listen to, any record that I listen to, unless it's a particular music that's just about beats, it is the voice that you listen to. So if you take your band, you take Spandau Ballet, you take Duran Duran, you take, I don't know, David Bowie, The Stones, whoever you listen to, the first port of call generally is the vocals, because that's the thing that's going to hit you. And if you can connect with the vocal in whatever way, whether you want discord or you want somebody who can't really sing but can express themselves, but there's still the voice that you listen to. If you listen to Bob Dylan, you wouldn't call Bob Dylan the world's best singer, but when he puts across a song, you believe what he's saying. You know, so I'm very flattered when people say that to me, but I realize that it's not because it's me, it's because it's the voice. And I think that's really important.
I think it's the voice, but it's also your persona was something... because you were very sort of stripped down and like you were saying, raw in the voice, but there was something so honest and straightforward about you, which I think, especially as it was at the time of punk and everything, that made you kind of, you know, we were all looking for kind of truth and reality. I think that helps do it as well.
Yeah, I'll have to leave that to you just to explain.
Who were the singers you aspired to? Because there was, you know, you weren't trying to sing like a big soul singer, like Aretha. In a way, you know, that Dylan sounds like a good a connection. But who are the female singers?
I was too busy writing my songs. You know, a lot of the people that we talk about weren't people. I started writing when I was 14. So that's 64. Well, I started writing earlier than 14. So 12, 13, 14. So that's 62, 3, 4. A lot of the people that we talk about, they weren't there. I know Aretha was there, but I wasn't really listening to that kind of music. I know Aretha. I thought she was absolutely, and still do think she was absolutely wonderful, and one of the best voices ever. But I was just too busy doing my own thing to think, let me be like that person.
And who was?
It didn't occur to me, really.
Who was turning you on? Who made you become a writer?
Your my mom. Well, no, not to become a writer. I was born to do this. So nobody said, Joan, write songs. It's because nobody showed me, like a lot of people, again, like a lot of other people. Nobody showed me, nobody said, Joan, why don't you try writing a song? This is how you write it. This is how you arrange it. Nobody said that. But what happened was when my dad wouldn't let me play his guitar, and didn't even want me to touch it. It made me want to play the guitar. But before that, my mum had bought a piano just as a piece of furniture, put it in the front room, and it literally, as soon as the piano came, I started writing songs. And the piano, as you know, really easy to play, not in an expert way, but it's really easy to play. You could sit on the piano and it makes a great noise. You see Jerry Lee Lewis, he'll sit on the piano and it sounds great. Mm-hmm. Elton, different people, they'll sit on the piano.
Yeah, Paul McCartney always talks about just, if you want to begin as a songwriter on the piano, just play the white keys, start with C and just
absolutely
only play the white keys.
Yeah, just put your hand anywhere, you're going to make something sound really nice.
Or do what Brian Ferry does and just play the black keys. Works just as well.
Irving Berlin apparently could only play the black keys. And he had
everything
piano
he ever wrote was in B flat.
That he could adjust the key with.
Yeah, absolutely. So playing the piano and making up my songs, and I've heard Paul McCartney say this as well, I'm quite good at melodies. I don't have to struggle to get a melody. So when you have the piano and you're just playing really simply, coming up with a melody was not a problem for me. And because I used to read a lot of the classics, you know, Dylan, Dickens and Shakespeare and Enid Blyton and everybody else, you know, Treasure Island, whatever, Mark Twain, I would read all of those things. And because I was so into the language and how things were expressed, I think the writing just came. And again, I think it was just something that I just had to do. Again, I'm not struggling to do it. But reading those things, I think, helped me to know how to kind of shape words. And then the guitar, as I say, was because my dad wouldn't let me play the guitar. So my mom got me the first guitar by swapping it for the two prams.
Hang on, whoa. Prams for a guitar. Could you, yes. You explain that?
Yeah, I saw this pram guitar in a pawn shop. And I said, yeah, can I have that? It costs £3. I said, can I have that? She said, we haven't got it, but if they'll swap these two prams for it, you can have it, which I still have the guitar. The guitar has no name, no maker. I can't find out who made it.
What is it? It's an acoustic.
Clumsy guitar, but it's just a cheap old guitar, but I loved it, still love it. If it wasn't for that guitar, I wouldn't be here now.
Do you still have it?
So yeah, my mom is, yeah, still have it. Yeah.
Wow.
My mom is the, when people say who's the inspiration or who's the person that kind of helped you to start, definitely my mother.
Because one thing I'd like want to know about at some point, Joan, is what guitarist you listen to? Because one thing I think, unless people have seen you live, is because you did a tour of Australia and New Zealand in 2007. It was a double headliner with Brian Ferry. And I was playing for Brian Ferry. And I used to come and watch you at the side of the, I used to come and watch you at the, an amazing band. Amazing band. John Giblin. And I used to come and watch you at the side of the stage because all of us were in awe at your lead guitar playing. You are such a great lead player.
So,
and that's not, you don't really sell that.
No question. And in fact, on the new on the new DVD live at Asylum Chapel, I was watching that the other day. And I mean, I was totally knocked out by the guitar playing.
Yeah, I like playing the guitar.
That's apparent.
Yeah, no, it's really, it's one of the reasons I like playing it because I think it's difficult. And it's quite, I've met lots of people who say, I'd love to play the guitar, but when I start, it's too painful, too difficult. I don't know where I am on the thing. I get blisters, you know, all of those things that would stop somebody from going from week one to week 67 or whatever. But I really like playing it. As you say, a lot of people don't seem to put me and playing leads together.
No, because there's singer-songwriter guitar, and then there's playing guitar. And, you know, yeah. So I'm... Who were the guitar? Were there guitarists you were listening to as well?
Point of my first album was 1972. At that point, I wasn't listening to guitarists. I was just, you know, when I started writing, I was just writing. Writing was it. I wasn't listening to anybody. But once I started, and you get past 72 or 70, and I start to listen, because I didn't, the first album I bought was Free, which would probably be 1970 or something, you know. It's not.
Cost off.
But then what I heard, then my second thing was Led Zeppelin, and that's Jimmy Page. And I thought Jimmy Page was just fantastic. And then it was Mountain, and I thought Leslie West was just phenomenal.
Yes.
Then I like Roy Gallagher, and I like Stevie Ray Vaughan, and I like Muddy Waters.
This is a great list. I love this.
Yeah, it's a great list. And Mark Knopfler is still my favorite guitarist. I just think he's just, how he plays is just wonderful. So I can give you a big list of guitarists that I really liked.
While you're here, Joan, I think we need to mention Jeff Beck.
There's another guitarist, and I saw him live. Fantastic. Yeah, that's really sad. I mean, we're all going to go. Don't worry. Once you're born, the only guarantee you've got is you're going to die.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't be too sad about that, because it's all of us that's our fate. Yeah. But sometimes I think, you know, how wonderful that these people were here to give us this huge talent. When you hear somebody like Jeff Beck play, the melodies, the technique, the tones, and he was a showman, but without being showy, you know. I thought he was,
and he's the way he crossed over into different music. I mean,
I used to say he was like the guitar version of hip hop. In that he would take anything. Danny Boy, Nessun Dorma, anything, you know, nothing was off limits.
That's the mark of a talent as well, though. There's not anybody that can do that.
I think I got to sort of introduce to him via Stevie Wonder, believe it or not, talking book. I think Looking for Another Pure Love was the first time I ever heard Jeff Beck, that I knew it was who he was, you know, as a guitar player. Let's go back to your journey. And one of the big sort of moments in your life was doing Hair, wasn't it? Because you then met someone like Pam Nestor, who then went on and you wrote with her. But how do you end up in Hair?
Well, I ended up in Hair because a friend of mine, we met on the streets, and he was going to do the audition. And he said, I'm going to audition for this thing. He didn't tell me what it was, just I'm going to audition for this thing. Just come with me. Not to audition, just to follow him.
Was this the first production?
So there was
groundbreaking stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, there was the London cast. So the London cast were already doing their thing, and they wanted a touring version of it. So that's what the audition was for. So we met. He said, "Come with me." Didn't tell me what it was about, but just to come with me, I went. When we got there, another friend of ours was there. And the two of them said, well, since you're here, you might as well audition as well. So I auditioned, I got through, they didn't. And then I found out what it was. And I really found out what it was when I went to see it for the first time in Manchester. Because once you pass the audition, that's when I saw it, because it was already in production. And then I saw it and I thought, okay, that's what I'm in. Let me just state now, there is no amount of money in the entire world or universe that would get me to take my clothes off. So that didn't happen. That's just not going to happen. But the thing itself was great. There was Richard O'Brien in there, Paul Nicholas, Paul Barber.
Oh, wow.
You know, that was the company. And in fact, Richard was writing the Rocky Horror Show at the time.
How cool is that?
Yeah. So it was great, and I really, really enjoyed it. Now, what used to happen every day when I was there, I would get up, go into the theatre, and write. So, and everybody knew that that's what happened. I'd just get up, go into the theatre, and write, and then everybody would come in later on for the rehearsal and whatever. And because Pam knew that that's what I did, one day she said, I've got some words. Could you put this to music for me? And I said, okay. And so I took those words and formed them into lyrics, and that's how that happened. And then, because as you know, as I've just said, I was writing before, from the age of 12, 13, 14, to meeting Pam. So it wasn't like I was looking for somebody to write with, or I was already writing. That was what I did. And it's because of my obsession with writing that she said, well, could you do that? So I did that. And then the first album came out, I did the, many of the lyrics were Pam's lyrics, my lyrics as well. Obviously, I did all the singing and playing and putting the songs as you know them. And then I just carried on my own, doing what I.
Just want to skip back. I just want one last question on Hair. Did you sing any leads on that, Joan? Any songs of your own?
The show would open with When the Moon Is in the Seventh High. So I would sing in that, and I played the guitar in it as well. So it was great. I absolutely loved it. But, it wasn't something that I thought, let me just continue into this thing, because I was just into writing.
I was going to say, you've never gone back to that sort of thing, have you?
No, because writing is, I'm just interested in writing.
Was it originally going to be a duet with you and Pam Nestor, or was it always your solo project and Pam was like your Bernie Taupin, if you like?
No, Pam Nestor was never my Bernie Taupin. I wrote from the age of 12, 13, 14. until now, 72, I wrote my own words. I didn't need somebody to write my words.
I'm wondering if maybe Gary Meads, if that's what she was thinking. That's what she was thinking, perhaps.
I'm not in somebody else's mind, so I don't know. But in terms of me, I was a songwriter who wrote words and music, and I wasn't looking for somebody to. Pam came to me. I didn't go to Pam. And it was great. I loved Pam. I thought she was a fantastic person. You know, very funny. We had a lot of laughs together. But it wasn't something that I wasn't struggling with writing words.
You had this amazing production team though, didn't you? I mean, Gus Dudgeon did it, who was obviously producing Elton at the time. In fact, Honky Chateau had been done at Chateau. Do you call it Chateau d'Urville? How do you pronounce it? Guy, you probably know the
I don't know. Is it D'Urville?
D'Urville? Chateau
That's
D'Urville?
Tess, isn't it?
Is that
Tess
right? D'Urville. Is that right, Joan? How do you pronounce this?
It's one of those.
Yeah. And so you went down there and you actually ended up with Elton's band in a way, didn't you? You got Ray Cooper, David Johnson on it and Gus producing it. What an incredible sort of nest of people to deliver that first record on.
Well, I was really lucky to have Gus as my first producer. And part of the luck was Gus realizing that I knew what I was doing. You know, when I go in with a song, it's a song. It's not a, here guys, I've got an idea for a chorus, or here's a riff, can we now extend that? Or I've got an idea for, no. You hear the song you hear is a song I've written. So wherever you hear a verse, a chorus or whatever, that's what I've written. If you hear something with really stripped down with just a piano and a guitar, that's what I've written. If you hear something with strings, that's what I want. If you,
right.
So it's not, and that was the beauty of Gus. Gus didn't say, look, John, you know, Elton's the biggest thing on the planet. I'm the person that's doing his productions. Don't you say a word. Let me sort it all out. That wasn't Gus. Gus was absolutely incredible. And he knew to allow me to express myself in the same way that you know, I know to allow musicians to express themselves. So even if I've written a bass part, for instance, I don't say to the bass player, look, I've written ABC in this meter, down, down, down. You must therefore play it exactly like that. I don't say that to people. They know that if I've written ABC, da, 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 they can go da, da, da. Or da 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 da. Oh, yeah. Do you know what I mean? They don't have to, and that's so you need people to express their skills.
Yeah, let me tell you and now. Guy Pratt would definitely not be listening to you. He would do his own thing.
I would absolutely listen. No, but I've got to say, I've always enjoyed the bass playing on your records. You always choose your players fantastically. And there's wonderful and the Asylum Chapel, Jennifer Maidman, it's fantastic all the way through.
I say, you need people, no matter what one person does, it's not all about them. You know, as wonderful as Love and Affection is, and I wrote it, and the thing of it is me, without Jimmy Jewell and Dave Maddox and Jerry Donahue, Glyn Johns, who again knew that I knew what I wanted and wasn't that kind of stifling thing. So you need people who have their talents that can express themselves. So that's really important.
Because ultimately it's expressing, you know, a unified vision, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we said, because for instance, with Love and Affection, is how it ended up sounding, was that kind of what you'd had in your head to begin with? Is that what you were hoping for?
Yeah, because, you know, all those... I would do my demos and I would sing parts, but obviously I can't sing as deep as that. So you get somebody in who can sing as deep as that. So I like to be as organized and as prepared as I can be when I'm writing and arranging the songs. But just to go back again, even though I've done that, musicians will express themselves and will bring themselves to the parts.
I know, you can't stop them, can you? It's a nightmare.
It's wonderful. You don't want to stop
and,
them.
And the thing is, you've had some, I mean, jumping forward, but we'll come back, but you've had incredible musicians. I mean, you get in when you start recording in your own studio, and you've got people like Tony Levin, Manu Katché, Daryl Jones, Greg Fillinganes, Adrian Ballou. I mean, you know, I mean, you are, this is Peter Gabriel, Kate Bush world. I just want to mention one track people should listen to on that first album, that Whatever's For Us album. It could have been better.
Yeah.
No, that's not me saying the album could have been better, Jake. You know, that's the name of the song.
That's a bold statement, Gary.
That's the name of the song. Now, Elton John apparently said he thought it was one of his favourites, or it was one of his favourite songs ever. But also, you know, there's another track on there called Visionary Mountains Guide. Yeah. Do you know who covered Visionary Mountains?
Yes.
Manfred Mann's Earth Band.
Yeah.
You know,
they did a very long version of that.
yeah. But that, It Could Have Been Better is a great tune.
Yeah, it's a good song. Thank you. And those are lyrics by Pam.
Yeah. Why didn't you stick with Gus on the next album?
I think there was a... So I made the Whatever's For Us, and then I didn't want to be on Cube anymore, which is what that was on. That was the label that was on. So there was a taking myself away from that label. I won't go into what that was about, but it was, I didn't want to be on that label anymore.
Did Cube have something to do with Mark Bolan's bug?
Mark Bolan was on that label.
Fly was
Fly,
wasn't it?
Yeah, Fly.
So
was
who
was
it from? So was it through a major? It was through a major label, though, wasn't it?
EMI?
No.
Well, it was its own label as far as I remember, and it had Nazareth and Boland and whoever, you know. So it had some. I'm trying to remember if Joe Cocker was on there at one point, but I maybe got that wrong. But it had people on there that were doing well, but I'm not going to get into what the thing was. But I left there, so there was a gap between that and Back to the Night came out in 75, and then at that point I'm on A&M, and Jerry Moss, the M of A&M, signed me to A&M. Actually, again, I'm not going to go into the whole thing. But
A of A&M is Herb Alpert.
Is Herb Alpert, yeah. So after signing with A&M, then I made the second album, and things change then, don't they? Things that
When you were going to A&M, when you left Cube, how was that? Was it were people queuing up? Was it like everyone wanted to give you a deal? Or
Jerry Moss was there even practically before I left. So I didn't. There was no kind of me having to search for another label. Jerry just picked me up.
Isn't there? There's an Elkie Brooks connection on your next record, wasn't there? Because it was with, is it Peter Gage
who produced
Vinegar Joe?
Elkie was fantastic. Elkie just came and did some cooking, and she was wonderful. I loved Elkie. She was really good.
I can see the connection between Elkie's work and yours, though.
Say that again.
I can see the connection between Elkie and you as vocalists.
You're entitled to if you want to.
And did that take you to America, Joan? That album.
So I went to America in 1973, so it would be before that album. And going to America in 73 would be, in fact, when I went to America for the first time in 73, it was literally just me and Stuart Copeland.
Stuart Copeland was your tour manager. Yeah.
Is that right?
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. It was just the two of us, and I was... Stuart wasn't playing or anything. He was just...
We saw Stuart just earlier this year. He came to see us play in Los Angeles.
Yeah, he came to see us.
What a nice man.
Loves Stuart. I'm surprised I was tempted to do like when Elton John used to do the show with just Ray Cooper, sort of with a bit of percussion. But Stuart wasn't tempted to, or you weren't tempted to have him up back. Or did you even know he played?
I knew he played, that's not what I was looking for. I'm just doing my thing.
is he a good tour manager?
he's a better drummer.
Well, no. You see, the thing was, because it was literally just the two of us, I didn't, he might say something different, but I didn't think of it in terms of Stuart's my tour manager. It was almost like two friends going and doing these gigs without one of them playing, one of them performing, just me performing. So I didn't think of, we just went about having a laugh or whatever.
I know what you mean, because I did a one-man show for years and a sort of comedy thing, and it would just be me with the guy who did my production and everything like that. And it's a lovely relationship.
It wasn't any kind of a, you'd have to ask Stuart what he thought, but for me, it was just...
Well, we will.
It was just two people going around, the States.
Which in itself is, I'm sure, for all of us English kids, that your first trip around America is so exciting, isn't it?
Well, exactly that, Guy, because I'm wondering how that influenced you as a writer. Did that change the way you wrote, seeing America?
Well, you talk about going back to New York to see all the things you didn't see.
Yeah, that's me writing.
That's true.
I loved it. I think it should be written into law that everybody should go to America. It's a very different place. And each state is very different and each city is very different. And the understanding of Americans for even the rest of America is very different. Yeah. it's quite incredible how insular Americans are. If you mention Paris to an American, they will think you're talking about Texas. So the Americans, but at the same time, Americans are very open to change, open to innovation, open to self-expression, open to people kind of progressing and building themselves up and getting promotion, and they're just into all of that stuff, and that's great. So if there's something you want to do, and if you're in another country and people are telling you it's not possible, go to America. They'll tell you, yeah, of course you can do it.
That's very true. But we have a very unique sort of relationship, Britain and America, with the arts generally, where they'll come up with an art form and it will come over here and we'll go, oh my God, that's amazing. And then we will filter it and mess around with it and then sell it back to them.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, or you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
go to drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. That's drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. Check it out. As a writer, though, Joan, I think I read somewhere that you don't write autobiographically. Although even though you write mostly in the first person. But stories are your thing. So are you an observer then of people, would you say?
Yes, and I've always been that. I've always enjoyed looking at people and seeing how they interact with each other, how they treat each other. And, you know, I spent the last 50 years saying these songs are about me, not about me. It would be weird to then write everything about myself. You know, you can't say these songs are not personal and then suddenly say, but they're all about me.
Yeah, so, I thought that was a really good point when you made it.
Yeah, very good because point. It doesn't make any sense. And also, who on earth would want to write every single song that they write about themselves? I've written hundreds of songs. Really? Come on.
Plenty of people. But although, is it true to say, although, because there are lots of character, but I wouldn't say that people think of you as a character-based songwriter, in that you're an emotional storyteller rather than a sort of situation storyteller.
Yeah.
Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I like to... I mean, when I hear people talking about what they do, sometimes they make it sound completely unique, and it's not. Very difficult to be completely unique. So when I talk about... I want people to be attached to the songs that I write and I want them to get an emotional connection to it. That's probably what most songwriters want. Nobody is going to write a song and say, I hope nobody connects to this. I hope they don't think this is part of how they think. You know, nobody's going to do that. So we're all trying to connect with people. We're all trying to give people an experience and help them to express things that they can't necessarily express for themselves. And that's why we admire novelists and people who can write, you know, great stories, because they're helping to express something that most of us know we can't do, you know.
Yes.
I can write loads of songs, I write hundreds of songs, but can I write a book? Do I know how to do that? I don't know. I've never done it.
Yeah, so. It's such a different talent, isn't it? But what's beautiful is, you know, sort of... And you're fantastic at this. It is the whole point of songwriting, as opposed to novel writing or something, is the distilling, isn't it? It's the paraphrasing.
Yeah.
It's taking something and reducing it to just a few words, you know.
Yeah.
And someone being able to go, you know. And it must be great. I mean, you obviously know that people are getting that from your work, and that in itself must be fantastically satisfying.
Yeah, no, it's great, because people tell me, and I'm sure Gary gets the same thing. People tell me this song has helped me to. Even for themselves, has helped me to express this feeling that I had that I couldn't quite put my finger on.
Yes.
And it's wonderful.
You become a voice for others.
I've had people say, I did an interview with this chap in Europe once, and he said, John, I'm going to propose to my girlfriend once we've done this interview, and I'm going to use your songs. You know, you can't get better, really.
Joan, I want to mention this, because in 1974, apparently, you were on the front cover of Spare Rib.
Yeah,
which was obviously the feminist paper at the time, and you know, people now can't imagine what it was like then. But to be a woman and competing in this world of rock music with such a male dominant, I mean, you know, we deal in rock music as on our show Rock on Tours, and you know, it's mostly blokes.
Yeah,
and. You know,
we don't like at all.
Yeah, but they're the ones who build. They were wielding the power in that period in the 70s.
Yeah. And I'm. You know, I always think I'm like the last person to talk about anything to do with music, because I haven't got a clue what's going on. I mean, my experience of pop music and the pop music world is very limited. I'm not a. I don't mix in the way that you're supposed to.
But did you feel it was harder for you, that you were treated differently because you were a woman at that time?
No, it wasn't. That's what I mean. You see, that's what I'm saying. I didn't find any harder for me part of it. I was just doing what I was doing. So if it was happening, it was happening without me. I was just writing my songs, playing my songs, just getting on with it. The only part that I would say I noticed properly was if I would ask a guitarist, how do you do this? How do you play that particular technique? What's that? And not one of them would tell me. They'd say, they'd say, oh, most men don't even get to that stage. Or in order to show you that, you need to know this. If I show you this bit, you need to know this bit first. Or that's really difficult, but you know, maybe one day you'll get there. So all my playing and my stuff, I'm on my own. No, nobody would show me. And I found that really interesting.
Because you weren't in the gang, as it were. There was a level of condescension.
Yeah.
And, mansplaining.
But I could never understand why wouldn't you show me that? It wasn't...
I think guitarists don't like to show anyone anything because they all like to do it. I think it's more to do with that.
I mean, what happens now in your career, and I think we're in 1976, is you end up with what is really the great marriage musically in your story, which is you and Glyn Johns.
Three
albums with Glyn. And of course, we're all totally obsessed with Glyn Johns now after seeing the Get Back documentary.
No,
how amazing
how cool
he looked. Was he dressed
Has there
up?
Ever been an engineer producer that you wanted to dress like?
Exactly.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness.
How cool.
Pop star, rock star, fashionista. Yeah. I mean, he was just looked great.
What was he like to work with?
Oh, Glyn was fantastic.
I was waiting to go nightmare.
No, Gus and Glyn, how lucky am I that I had these two people in my life and working with?
How lucky are they? Sorry, but you know, this goes both ways.
Oh, it goes both ways, but I'm just talking from my side and
I know you, I know.
Gus and Glyn, just absolutely wonderful. And Glyn, still wonderful. Gus, I was friends with from the day we made the album to the day he died, and Glyn, I'm still friends with, and you know, it's the two, we're talking about a talent, because they both had a talent, they both got this thing, they know how to manipulate sound, they know how to deal with people, because that's very important in the studio, that you deal with the musicians in a kind of a caring way, if you like. You know, I don't think you need to be shouty to people to get the best out of them.
So did Glyn come
you just
to
need
you?
A nice atmosphere.
Yeah,
absolutely. Were you and Glyn, did you have a meeting with Glyn and you went, right, now here's Down to Zero, here's Love and Affection, here are these songs, and he just sort of stood there with his jaw hitting the ground?
Well, in terms of presenting the songs, yes, that's because, as I say, when I write the song, it's written, so there's no... Okay, everybody in the studio, here's a little bit of a verse. Now let's make it the song. No, there's none of that. I've written the song. But when Glyn met me first, and he could tell you the story himself, he came to America to see me in a theater. And he said he thought he couldn't see what the record company was talking about, because they were the ones who said, go and see Joan and maybe you could produce her. But he couldn't see it. And he said the sound was horrible. I wasn't talking to the audience. He just thought, nah, it's not for me. So he went back and said to the record company, no, sorry, I'm not interested. And they said, you're wrong. You should meet Joan one-on-one. So we met and I played in a couple of things and then he changed his mind. And then we worked together. And it was... absolutely fantastic. And again, you have to mention the musicians on the album, because that thing of the album working as well as it works, of course, ultimately, everybody to work together to make that thing end up the way it ends up. And so the reason that it works is because we're all working together. And we all knew at the time of making that record that we had made something that was really good. Everybody knew and felt. You guys must have gone through the same thing.
Did they all stand around and sort of listen to the songs and then You had a great line. You had Kenny Jones playing drums.
Kenny Jones, yeah.
Gallagher and
Dave
Lyle.
Massett, Graham Lyle.
Yeah.
Graham Lyle.
Yeah.
Who's Gallagher and Lyle, right, guys? Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely right. Yeah. Clark Peters.
He's the bass voice on Love and
Well, hang on. Clark Peters was kind of in my family story in that my wife's father produced Bubbling Brown Sugar.
Right.
Is that the same Clark Peters? Have I got that right?
He wrote Five Guys Called Mo. He's best friends with my brother-in-law.
Yeah, his name is Pete Clark. And when he went to the Equity, there was already a Pete Clark. So he had to change his name to Clark Peters.
But it's quite funny. If you had a Peter Clark and a Clark Peters, you'd say, which one's the American? It's obviously Clark Peters.
Yeah, it's obviously Clark Peters.
Do you know what else? I think Glyn Johns choosing Dave Mattox was brilliant.
Well, Glyn chose all the...
Next question was where the musicians came from.
Glyn chose all the musicians, apart from Pete, who I wanted this bass voice. And that goes for all the albums that I do, unless I'm playing everything myself. All the albums that I make, somebody else will tell me who the musicians suggest the musicians. So it'll be the producer. It'll be Gus who'll say these are musicians that we should work with, or Glyn, or Richard Goddard, or whoever it is, because I don't know anybody.
You did actually in about 1990, Joan. You did actually call me up about doing something.
I did,
and yeah. And it was you personally.
Okay.
And I was absolutely gobsmacked, and I couldn't do it, or something went wrong.
1990.
Yeah, but around 1990, 89, 90, yeah. I remember I spoke to you on the phone.
Was it the plumbing she needed? She was looking for a plumber.
Terrible mistake. So you have.
So if I called you,
Maybe it was for a tour. Maybe it was for a tour.
It would more than likely be somebody's suggestion because I generally don't know anybody. So it's always the producer that recommends people to me.
Anyway, well, it was very nice of you to call, and
thank you.
It was incredibly flattered.
But I tell you who else. I tell you who else called her, Guy.
Who?
Not a bit earlier than that, but called her, not you, not the other way around. Was Bob Dylan. Got in touch with you,
that's
didn't he,
right,
Joe?
Yes,
in the late 70s, didn't he?
78.
Tell us about that.
Bush, yes, all the people. I didn't personally get the call, but all the people on Blackbush were people that Bob Dylan wanted. So there's myself, Eric Clapton,
Graham Parker.
What was Blackbush?
Blackbush, Airfield thing. And I think it still holds the record for the amount of people at a person's gig. No, because it wasn't a festival, it was his gig. And that's where I met Ringo for the first time. I think Ringo was probably the first Beatle I met.
How was Dylan? How was Bob? He knew your work.
Lovely. Yeah. I mean, you know, he chose people that he... like. In fact, I think he in one of his... books that he mentions me in one of his books in a line saying she does something like Joanna Macheri or something. I don't know. He was great. He was very friendly, very, you know, just like a normal person, just super talented. That's all.
No. What was it like when you first heard about that? Was that like sort of, I don't know how important Dylan was to you. Was it like being anointed? You know, that's only a few people, right? He's
only
for this gig, and you're one of them.
Yeah, no, it felt great, obviously. Yeah, yeah, it felt great.
She's being modest about this.
It's not a great question. I'm sorry about that.
No,
it was all right. It was all right.
The thing is, and I know I'm not supposed to say this, but I'm not starstruck. What I do is I appreciate people. And I appreciate people and their talents. And I think, how incredibly talented are you? My goodness, you were given that gift and look how you've used it. And I just go on that. I don't think you're not of this earth.
Imagine as well, when you get there, you're just nervous, you know, you're like all of us, you'd be just like concentrating on your own performance. You're not really.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not nervous I'm not nervous to meet people. So I'm nervous to go on stage because the people I'm going to meet are going to be many and they're all going to be looking at me and saying, okay, what can you do? And I have to make sure that I live up to what they think I can do. So I try my best with that. But in terms of meeting people one-on-one or whatever, they're just people.
When you went out on tour...
Talented, don't get me wrong, you know, geniuses, my goodness, you know, as I say, how amazing are you? And I love that you're here to show us this.
When you went out on tour, did you get to, with these albums, did you get to take the musicians that were working with you on the album, or was that a whole reinvention you have to do?
Yeah, in general, no, it'd be the different musicians. Because a lot of the musicians were session musicians.
What you were very clever at, Joan, was working your way into the 80s, weren't you? Because because there was definitely a different sound. You know, me, myself, I, you know, I mean, you've got Chris Spedding is on that
yes!
record, isn't he?
Yeah.
We love Chris. Chris came on the show a few months ago.
Right.
But that was, I can't remember.
Chris was on that tour in Australia.
Who produced that?
Richard Goddard. Yeah, Richard Goddard.
Was there a sense, was that you wanting to sort of, there was never a sense of record companies saying, look, Joan, you've got to kind of like change this or change that.
No.
Get a bit more electronic. Or because there was an album later on, you had Tom Dolby on it, you know.
Yeah, no. What you hear is what I've written. It's not anybody telling me, do this, do that. I just write what I want. I use what I want. Synthesizers are in. So I wrote, I'm lucky, you know, because that's what I was doing. So there's nobody saying, make this more rock or make this more synth or make this more acoustic. What I'm the one that will do whatever you hear on the records.
Like, because me, myself, I, you got half the E Street Band on here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's Paul Schaffer, Clarence Clemens.
Yeah.
Yeah, Clarence.
Marcus Miller.
Yeah, Marcus.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
All lovely
you
people.
All the bass players, haven't you?
Yeah. And
if you're letting other people choose for you, you're very, very lucky.
Well, no, it's because they're very talented.
Yeah.
The people who are choosing are very talented, and they know other talented people. That's. I mean, for me, if I was to choose everybody all the time, well, I don't know, but I might just stick with certain people, and I love change, and that's why I would change my band as well, because I love change. I love seeing what other people can do. It's really nice. So it's great to have people who know what they're doing, and they can say, look, here's this bass player that I've been working with on this particular thing. He's wonderful. I think he could work with you. Or he's wonderful for this project, but maybe not for that project. Do you know what I mean? So it's really nice, and I'm very happy to let people show me new musicians. Not worried about them at all.
Because on Walk Under Ladders, you've got an amazingly eclectic group of musicians. I mean, it's, you know, like Tony Levin, Robbie Shakespeare. I mean, you really have got all those.
Andy
players.
Partridge plays
Andy
guitar.
Andy Partridge.
Yeah.
How did, what's, tell
again,
us about that.
Again, Steve Lillywhite would have said, you know, how about these guys?
Yeah.
So it's not, all I do is write songs. I write and arrange and sing it and arrange it and whatever, but I'm not the person that's going to say have that person play on it.
But if they come in and you don't like what they've done or you don't think it's working
out,
obviously.
They're off.
They're off. Can I just say,
of course.
This period of time, all the way from America, what a song that is.
Yeah, what a song.
Where did that come from?
And in fact, the Asylum Chapel version of that is really lovely.
Where did that come from, Joan?
That came from when I was in America. There was this chap who was kind of trying to get me to go out with him, and I came back to Britain, and he would not stop calling. So that's actually where All the Way from America comes from.
Right. You do change producers quite a bit, because by the time you get to the key and drop the pilot, you've got a different producer.
Yeah.
Completely. Again, Drop the Pilot, another, I mean, it's just classic after classic, isn't it? As you're going from, you're already now 10 years into your, more than 10 years into your career, and you're managing to sort of roll with the punches of what's going on in in different styles and genres. You know, we all know the changes that happened in the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, and but you're managing to stay in the game. Was there ever a sense of that, that you couldn't just plow your own furrow? You had to be staying in the game that was and inspired by the changes that were going on around you.
Well, for me, the changes that were going around were the technical changes. So you'd have a period where it was very acoustic, and then you'd have a period where it was very lots of synths. And because I'm interested in technology, I'm interested in, you know, what the current technology is for music, I'm going to use that. So that's why you have synth things when it's synth time, because that's what it is. So I would start off with, when I was writing, I had my little cassette. Then I got my 2-track, then my 4-track, 8-track, 16-track, 24-track. And then it became a computer. So I got my Cubase, and, you know, then I got my Logic. And, you know, so everything that's happening, I just work with what the technology is. And the technology will tell you it's time for aggressive guitar playing or something, because mm-hmm. that's the technology. The different plugins are coming in or whatever, different effects. And so you had lots of, there was a point where there was lots of reverb and echo and stuff like that, and delays on things. So I would just go with that rather than, so if you notice, my music is not necessarily trying to be whatever the style is, but it's definitely whatever the technology thing is.
Yeah. Did you ever splash out on a Fairlight?
No, I didn't.
Well done.
Very few people are that.
Very few people happy about that investment.
But did you fundamentally sit at a piano or a guitar to write a song? And then go to the arrangements for yourself?
Yeah, I always write the song first, because I need to know that I can play the song as a song. So even now, I still write on the guitar and the piano. I write on the phone, the iPhone. Now, instead of the cassette or whatever, so I'll put a lot of stuff down on the iPhone, and then I'll go to Logic, and then I'll sing the song, do the arrangements. I think it's important to, if you're writing a song, that you can play the song. So if somebody said, "Can you play whatever it is on its own?" It sounds like that song still.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's another point, because what you just said about your songs are your songs, but the recordings can be affected by the technology of what's happening at the time. So, but mm-hmm. do you have, because you know your records do tend to be very beautifully produced, do you have a sense when you're in the studio of thinking, am I going to be able to translate this production, not the song, but this production to life?
No, because I know the song will be all right.
Yeah.
As long as the song is working.
Doesn't rely on the instrumentation.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So if you have the, I don't know, take something like, say take something like Heading Back to New York City, which is very electric guitar riff driven. I could still play that on the acoustic and have it sound good.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Did you know, Guy, that Joan is on a Queen record?
I did, but if it's better for the show, I'll say no, I didn't.
No, you did, but then you did. But I didn't until yesterday. I can't even remember what album it's on.
I can't remember what it's album. I just know it's a
Kind of Magic. It's on a Kind of Magic, 1986.
I'll tell you how that happened. We were at the townhouse. I must have been doing The Key, maybe, or Walk on the Ladders, maybe. Anyway, we were at the townhouse together, and Roger Taylor came into the studio and said, "Joan, we're just doing this track. Do you want to come in and just speak these words for me?" And so I said, "Get out of here. What do you mean going to come in and interrupt me?" No, I said, "Yeah, of course." So I went over and I did the thing that he asked me to do, and then went back to the studio. That was it, and it was great. It was, you know, and Roger, I love Roger. He's so nice.
He's lovely. Yeah.
All those. I mean, I never met Freddie, but I've met Roger and by men. Lovely people, so nice.
Talking about meeting
that's
lovely...
when you were doing Walk Under Ladders, because if you're at the townhouse, yeah. if you're working with Steve Lillywhite, you're definitely at the townhouse.
It was a townhouse.
Talking yeah. about meeting lovely people, I met you, Joan, but you probably don't remember. I met you at a Prince's... Not that I'm a lovely person. I mean, you're the lovely person. I met you at Air Studios, I think, with right. Prince Charles and Princess Diana. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, yeah.
It was for the Prince's Trust, and it was a kind of thank you to people who had been involved in the Prince's
Trust.
That's
right.
And I remember it was at Air Studios in Oxford Street, right, Guy? So what happens was the cars all pull up, the limos, and the artists all get out and they wave at the crowd that's formed and at the press and the photographers. There were even snipers on the roof, right? On the roofs, because obviously this is royalty.
In case you got out of hand.
Yeah. And you wave and then you turn and you walk into Air Studios, right? Mm. So we all got out of our car a little bit up the street because the queue was backing up. And we walk up the street, Spandau Ballet. And we turn, we wave at the photographers and all the fans. And we turn around, we walk in to Dulce's shoe shop. which has a little door that goes inside before the main door. And we walk in and push the door. And of course, it was shut at that point. And I could hear people in the crowd going, they've walked into Dulce's. They've gone, they're not even, you know, so it was a very embarrassing moment. But I did get to meet them. I've got a photograph. It was a photograph of us all lined up with that my mum and dad had hanging on their living room wall for right. until they died. And I have it now.
Yeah, no, that was, yeah, I remember that. And I've been involved with the Prince's Trust since 83 and was an ambassador for a while, and I'm now one of the trustees of the trust. And I just think the King now, when he started the Prince's Trust, the work that the trust does is quite phenomenal. It's absolutely incredible. That not only have they saved, as he saved lives, but has helped people to kind of make their fortune, you know, helped with businesses, helped with just self-acknowledging that they are capable of doing things, you know, because quite a lot of the people who the trust has helped had no confidence in their abilities, and the trust has helped them to realize that they're worth it and they can do stuff. And that's a pretty valuable thing. It's a priceless thing, actually, to have somebody have confidence. So I'm really quite proud to be a part of the trust.
Brilliant. No, I couldn't agree with that more. Actually, Joan, I'm up in Yorkshire. I'm with my missus, Georgia Bing, as a children's author. And she's doing a tour of primary schools, just telling children they can write. And they, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
You know, all
yeah. Part, I mean, I absolutely, I believe that it's important for each person to know for themselves how good they are. I don't believe that you need to wait for somebody to tell you how good you are. But if you don't have the confidence to know that for yourself, then you do yeah. need somebody to help you to know that you can do it. And I just watched a program with this jewelry maker girl, and she obviously knew she could make jewelry because she was making it and selling it, but not in the quantities that she needed. But having come onto this program in this kind of thing that they help you and mentor you, and then they tell her, you're wonderful, you've done this, look how great this thing is, and she burst into tears. And the reason she burst into tears was because somebody was telling her how good she was.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was so sweet. Yeah. And I was really happy for her that she finally got the confirmation that she needed, that she was good. So that was great. And sometimes if you haven't got the strength to do it yourself, then you do need people to help you.
What we never mentioned in our introduction, Joan, was you've had 3 Grammy nominations. I think one of those, mm-hmm. wasn't one of those quite unique? Wasn't it one of the first British?
Yeah.
What was that?
Yeah, that was for Into the Blues. So it was first female artist for to be nominated in the blues category. First female artist to debut at number one.
That's amazing.
With the blues, yeah.
You've got a lot of firsts, Joan. That must be a good feeling.
I do have a lot of firsts. Yeah, it's a nice feeling.
So, but to still be knocking down, you know, opening doors, as it were.
Knocking down and opening.
I mean, yeah.
Whatever.
Sometimes you're not, sometimes you kick them in.
kicking down doors.
And also you got Women of the Year award last year, didn't you?
Yeah, I got Women of the Year award. And it's, you know, it's great to get people telling you, we admire this thing about you. This is the only way we can express it here, have this award or have this nomination. It's a wonderful thing. Sometimes I hear people say it doesn't matter. I think it does, because it's expression, isn't it? It's people expressing something.
Of course it matters. It's a fantastic thing.
It's a nice thing.
But there's a thing.
Yeah, it's great.
A thing I read about Joan, about you, that apparently, was it very early on, either someone at the record company or somewhere said, you should wear a dress and change your name, whatever. And you said no. Now, looking back, do you think it's probably a really good thing that that happened to you, but that you managed, because you said no then and sort of then found out really early on that you could just be yourself, you know, be the person you wanted to be?
I mean, it's not because of record companies telling me.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
To do something.
But what I'm saying is the opposite of that. The very fact that someone said that and you said no made you aware that, you know, that you could say no and just be that.
No, I've always known I could say no.
Good. All right. Good.
That's not something I learned in the. That's not something I learned in the music business.
I don't mean learning. I just.
No. I know what you're saying. Yeah, I know what you're saying. But I.
He's looking for a moment in the movie when they do the, when they do your biopic, right. Joan.
Yeah, that's it. No.
I play you. What?
No. This is the what this thing that you see is this thing that's always been.
We should mention your book of lyrics, which has just come out. The Weakness in Me.
The Weakness in Me. Looks like a beautiful thing.
And
it's really good, yeah.
Absolutely a fantastic thing to be delivering to us now. Has it got a nice introduction by anyone that we should mention? Or
Glyn Johns. Introduction.
Beautiful.
It was really nice. And the way that came about was, I mean, I it would not have entered my head to do a book of my lyrics. So Faber and Faber came to me and said, we'd like to do a book of your lyrics. So that was great when they said that. And I thought, oh, actually, that's a really good idea. I kind of wish I'd thought of it.
Faber did Kate Bush the year before, didn't they? So that's, you know, this is great company you're in.
Yeah, and they've done, I think they did the Pet Shop Boys and the different people they've done. I actually wasn't aware that it had been done. So they came and said, what do you think? And I thought, my God, that sounds quite nice. And it's a lovely looking book, and people seem to have taken to it, which I'm really pleased about.
It's been lovely having you on, Joan. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. I'm sorry I'm not pop star, rock star enough.
You are Joan. You are Joan Armour trading, for God's sake. I mean, you've been in my life for 50 years. Yeah. I mean, listen, you've delivered, you know, you've been in my, you know, my record collection and in our world. And Guy and I are more than honoured to have you on, even
Absolutely.
Though you can't tell us stories of sort of cocaine nights with, you know, Eddie, wherever it might be. we are more than happy to listen to your story because it's inspiring.
That is it's a real honour to have you, Joan. It really is.
Excellent. You are. Thank you. Very nice.
50 years. And we're tipping into 51 now. Come on, it's 23.
But we are. Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Is there? Are you going on the road?
No, I. The last tour was 2018, and I decided in like 2014, 15, that 2018 would kind of be the last time I did any big tours. So, and I did the live stream in 2021 because I knew I wasn't going to go on tour in that way anymore. Not that I'm not never going to do another live show, but I just don't want to be on the road. So there's no plans at the moment to do any touring.
Well, but I would advise everyone to go and check out Live at the Asylum Chapel because it really is fantastic.
Yeah, and keep an eye on her website in case she changes her mind.
Yeah.
Joan, what a pleasure. What a great pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for asking me.
Yes, what a story.
What a story. What a woman.
I mean, fantastic. One thing she never mentioned is how her... St. Kitts and Barts, I think she comes from there.
That's right, yeah. She came over on a plane on her own when she was 7 years old.
Because her parents had already gone to Birmingham.
Yeah.
That's amazing, isn't it? So you can see the independence would have started with that story, I guess.
But no, she was wonderful and so bubbly and fun.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
But with so much, she's
youthful,
got so much
gravitas. Youthful.
Yeah.
I mean, you know. Been 50 years and still youthful, still passionate. Okay, so listen, thank you so much to Ben Jones for producing for Gimme Sugar. And anyone else who helps us get this thing together and finds us lovely people to talk to. And I think we've got someone good next week, haven't we?
We've got someone very good next week. We've got someone good every week. Come on.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to try and turn
How do we do it? How do we do it? That's what I want.
Well, you're going to be doing it from some manor house in the north, in North Yorkshire.
I'm somewhere weird.
Are you, or something?
I don't know where I am next week. It's funny. It's
boat,
actually more manic than
a boat
sources.
Off of Whitby. In a
yes,
coffin.
With a coffin in hold. With earth keeps leaking out.
I look forward to your next next location.
Locale.
All right. All the best. It's good night from me.
Good night from them.
Rock on Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.